Just leave it on the table there. Marshall will take care of that. Thank you.
Mr. Strauss, it's a pleasure meeting you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Nick, you want to check and see if the counsel for respondents here on the next matter? Oh, they're coming in. They may have got the word. There you go. All right, good morning.
Good morning.
Our next matter for calendar is files 18-1569 and 1579, State of Minnesota versus William Cornell Walker. Counsel for each party here will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, as I'm sure you're aware. Feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort, and please start your arguments by identifying yourselves for us for the record. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Rochelle Nguyen. I'm a state public defender, and today I'm representing William Walker. Mr. Walker was convicted after a jury trial of third-degree criminal sexual conduct. At sentencing, Judge Connell granted Mr. Walker's motion for dispositional departure, stayed execution of his 48-month sentence, and placed him on probation, requiring him to serve 270 days in prison and a number of terms of probation. The state appealed from the sentence and requested oral argument. Mr. Walker appealed from the judgment, and the appeals were consolidated by this court for review. So the main issue I wanted to address today is the issue Mr. Walker is more concerned with, which is whether or not this court should interfere with Judge Connell's decision to place him on probation. And this court's well aware of the standard of review, well aware of the abuse of discretion standard. I think probably the most interesting part of this case deals with how this court has actually treated these cases. I just did a quick search while I was in the lobby of the last year of unpublished cases dealing with dispositional departures. And since January 2018, you've had 28 unpublished cases. Of those 28, six have been appeals by the state, and the other 22 have been by the defense. And this court has unanimously agreed and treated both cases the same, which is this court does not interfere. So the real issue comes down to this, is whether or not the district court actually had valid factors and whether or not the record supported those factors. I'm sure this court has, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'll just ask you my question then, because I think it'll get into your argument. So here the sentencing judge didn't use the magic word particularly. And so whether you address it now or address it in your argument, what's the significance of that? How does that weigh into our decision?
No, there's no significance in it. And unfortunately, this case, when I looked at the unpublished cases, this argument has actually come up before by the state, that the court hasn't used the magic word particularly. And the way this court has dealt with it is to say that is not the issue, and it's not relevant necessarily. The issue is whether or not the court identifies the valid factors, because this court is more concerned with identifying the factors and determining whether or not they're permissible factors. Because sometimes, and this is what has happened, is the district court will identify a factor and this court will intervene and say his employment status may not necessarily be a factor we want to look at, because not everybody's going to be employed, or you know, whether or not they can pay fines. There are certain factors that this court will look at and say that is not a factor we're going to look at. What this court looks at is, are you identifying appropriate factors, and does the record support it? So here it really comes down to, what were the factors identified by the district court? This court looked at the prior record. It also looked at his cooperation, his family ties. But most importantly, I think, is it looked at something that doesn't always happen, which is the psychosexual report. And I thought what was really interesting about this judge is it wasn't so much at what he looked at that supported the treatment and the probation. I think what was more important is what he looked at that actually necessarily did not go in Mr. Walker's favor. And so he spent quite a bit of time looking at this issue of remorse and his attitude and his struggle, even in the psychosexual report, which was, you know, clearly detailed.
In terms of the psychosexual report, the district court indicated that Walker had a low risk of reoffending, but when you look at all three tests, he had a low risk on one of the tests, but the combined score for all three tests put him in the moderate range is my reading of the report.
Can you address
that?
So what I went through, and because we're not, I don't know what this stuff means. So I read it very carefully. And so I actually sat down and I broke down what the language was. And so the way I read it was this. So they have the static 99. Mm-hmm. The static 99 predicts future offense rates. So that's what it says. It's what's going to happen in the future. And on that particular test, he scored low to moderate. The second test, another component, was the stable 2007 and the second tool was the acute 2007. And those actually are different tests. They don't predict future recidivism. They look at short-term intermediate and whether or not the person is going to do something in the now. So after going through, what I realized is there are three different components. And what the study said is each of these don't necessarily work the best. It's better to combine them in different forms. And so there were actually two combinations. One combination was placed him, and this is, I'm not going to try to interpret what this means, but I just took the language out of it. The scores placed him in the low to moderate risk/needs category. The second combined placed him in the moderate for current risk and supervision for general criminal recidivism. I don't know what that means. I think the judge read it like I read it, and he looked at the future to offend and said low to moderate. I think this court can say you read it wrong or your interpretation isn't how we have it and say moderate. That's not going to change the outcome of this case. I think what's most important is the judge did what you did and what I did. And what a lot of judges don't do, he sat down and he read that whole report and he talked about it at sentencing. And maybe he didn't get the language exactly right, but he struggled with it and he considered it. And I think that's all you can ask a district court to do and then look at whether or not the factors he cited were valid. Here, I think they were valid. I think the record supported what he said. And given this court's standard of review and how it has looked at these cases in the last year and its unpublished cases, I think the only outcome is that this judge exercised its discretion and didn't abuse it. Thank you.
In light of the Soto case, how does age support a departure?
You know what? I agree with the state. I think in this case, age doesn't support it in the way that it is termed in Soto, which is a juvenile, someone who's 18. However, I think the judge looked at the age a different way. When you look at his sentencing, he looked at his age with respect to his criminal history score. He said, this is a 34-year-old man, and the whole time of his life, he's had a series of petty misdemeanors and one misdemeanor. And I think that was actually a valid way to assess his age within the context of his criminal history. And if you look at his sentencing, that's the way the judge actually meant it. And I do understand what the state is saying, that in some cases, if you have a juvenile and they're particularly young, you might consider it. But I don't think there was anything wrong or there was an abuse of discretion in the way that this judge interpreted that factor. Thank you.
Okay. I have a couple more questions for you.
Happy to serve.
So I guess in summary, how do you see this case being distinguishable from the Soto case?
This court sees a lot of these crimes. We see a lot of these crimes. And I have to be honest, when you see crim sexes, they're different. And I don't think there's anything wrong with district courts looking at them different. I think that the key thing is, in the end, you have to look at the individual and ask yourself this. Is this person being treated differently than other people in similarly situated cases? And I think in the Soto case, you can say, yeah, you're being treated differently. In this case, you can look at the statistics here. District court judges who see the same defendant, zero criminal history score with this crime, in 50% of the cases since 2012 to 2016, 50% of the district court judges did what this district court judge did. And I think of all the statistics and factors I've cited, that probably is the most important.
I assume that also, though, includes plea agreements and jury findings.
Yes, it included all according to the sentencing guidelines.
Of that percentage, there may be a number of them where the parties have agreed to a dispositional departure.
They may, but even when that happens, this court will step in, and if it is not supported, it will not sustain it.
I got you.
Now, before I leave again, I want to make sure I've answered all the questions.
Just on the issue that you raised on appeal, you're not disputing that your client agreed to speak with the police after being informed of his Miranda rights?
No. In fact, the facts show that what the officer said was he volunteered some information, and then he said, before he could really talk, he said, I'm going to give you your Miranda warning. And then they had a discussion. He described it as a short discussion, and at that point, he was arrested, and that was it. So on my issue, I think the only point I wanted to make is, if you look at the cases cited by the state, those are all impeachment cases. The case they cite in their brief, it's an impeachment case. The initial questioning and the way it's raised in my brief, there is a very clear line, black letter law, and that's Rainwright versus, it's in my notes, Greenfield. That, and this is a very narrow field, there's pre-arrest, pre-Miranda. The state in its case in chief can never introduce the fact that a defendant did not tell his whole story to prove a substantive evidence guilt. Black letter law, no issue. Every case cited by the state, every case deals with cross-examination, impeachment. A completely different area of
doesn't
law.
Doesn't Darvaux say that defendant doesn't have a right to remain selectively silent?
On impeachment.
Okay. But do any of the cases that you're citing to involve a defendant who agreed to talk to the police after being given his Miranda warning?
Billups actually is a case where he spoke after he's given his Miranda and denies involvement. And so if you look, actually, I think I wrote the facts down real quick because I thought that was pretty interesting. In Billups, he was given Miranda and he denied involvement afterwards. And in that case, they said you couldn't impeach him with his failure to give an alibi. So you can impeach him in most cases, if what they're doing is given a prior inconsistent statement.
Which case are you citing to?
That's Billups. So he did give a statement after Miranda. And Devereaux is consistent with Billups because they deal with impeaching when you've given one set of statements and the statements you give are inconsistent. Once a defendant takes the stand and he's given statements to the police and then he testifies and gives inconsistent statements, he can be impeached. I have no problem with that. The problem comes when you cross the line between impeaching about the statements you give versus going for the silence, which you didn't give. And it gets a little, if you look at the facts of all the cases that we cite, it's pretty interesting because there isn't a clear line. The only clear line is what you can't do and what the state can never do is before the defendant has taken the stand, the state cannot introduce evidence of silence or failure to give their whole story. That they can't do, that they have never been able to do. And I think that's where the confusion comes from the state, because if you look at Anderson versus Charles, Billups and Devereaux, those are all impeachment cases where the state opens the door after the defendant has taken the stand. And that is a different standard than when it's the state's case in chief, which is clearly what happened here. Thank you.
All right, counsel for responding.
I Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the state of Minnesota in these consolidated appeals. This court should affirm the defendant's conviction because under State v. Darvo, the prosecutor properly asked about defendant's failure to provide critical exculpatory details to police and therefore did not commit prosecutorial misconduct. On the other hand, this court should reverse the district court's decision to grant a downward dispositional departure because under Soto, defendant is not particularly amenable to probation, and accordingly, the district court abused its discretion when it departed from the guideline sentence in this case.
So can you address the Billups case that was just referenced by counsel for appellant?
I was working on getting it up, but I didn't quite have a chance before counsel finished. So let me take a look at that. First of all, I think it's instructive that Billups is decided before Darvo and before Anderson. I think that is very instructive, and I think the reality is that the Doyle holding and the Billups holding are modified by Anderson, and they're modified by Darvo. Darvo is pretty clear and pretty straightforward, and it doesn't say anything in the opinion that I'm aware of about limiting that to questions of impeachment. Because the important and critical distinguishing factor for both the Anderson court and the Darvo court was the fact that the defendant was not induced to remain silent by the Miranda warning, but instead elected to waive his right to remain silent and speak with the police. And so both the Anderson court and the Darvo court embraced the notion that you can't selectively remain silent, so that once you talk to police, your omission of details is fair game. And there's nothing in the holdings of those cases that says that's limited to the purposes of impeachment. And to the extent that there was any alleged error in examining Chief Jara in the state's case in chief, The prosecutor questioned Chief Jara about what the defendant said in connection with the Minnesota case, did ask a couple of questions what he didn't say, but he asked, but he never said that the incident in Adrian was consensual. That was in contradistinction to him testifying that the incident in Iowa was consensual. Did he ever mention that this was some misunderstanding? No. Did he ever mention that Ms. Carter was fabricating the entire incident? No. Those questions about not mentioning specific details, one, are fairly insignificant in what we're talking about here, and two, they were properly addressed, I think, by counsel's own concession at this point in time, on cross-examination of the defendant. So that to the extent that there was any plain error in the prosecutor asking these questions in its case in chief, it couldn't have had a substantial impact on the verdict here, because the prosecutor asked those same questions to the defendant.
But does the defendant's decision to testify or not? Do the fact that those questions were asked of Chief Jara during the state's case in chief before the defendant testified, does that somehow factor into whether or not he would have chose to testify in the case?
Well, I suppose it may theoretically factor into that, but we have to remember what we're talking about here is plain error, and that we're talking about error that if there is error, it must be plain error. So the defendant, who was in the best position to know that he claims, he didn't talk to the cops, should have objected to this testimony, should have brought a motion in limine or had an omnibus hearing on the question of what of anything that he did or didn't say to the police was admissible.
Right. On that topic, you're arguing that there was no prosecutorial error, and that's why the plain error test would apply. What does that have to do with whether or not the prosecutor erred in extrapolating this testimony?
that bit doesn't bear directly on the question of whether the prosecutor erred. I think the fact that we're having a debate about whether competing strains of Miranda jurisprudence apply to this particular fact scenario demonstrates that the prosecutor's asking the question couldn't possibly have been plain error. That there were fact questions that had antecedent fact questions that had to be resolved. Whether the defendant did in fact remain silent and was induced to do so by his Miranda warnings, or whether he spoke to the police. And then whether there was any silence that can't or can be inquired after. And that requires a resolution of what cases control. To suggest, when we're here discussing interesting distinctions between numerous different lines of case law, whether there was plain error, I think, answers the question. And accordingly, the onus was...
I mean, there isn't a clear rule or...
Correct, because it's a very fact-dependent area of inquiry. There was no clearly controlling case law that applied to this scenario. There were, at least as the trial record establishes, factual disputes. The defendant claimed on cross-examination that he didn't say anything to the police, which directly contradicts Chief Jara's testimony at trial, which suggests that there were antecedent factual determinations that had to be resolved about the admissibility of any questionable evidence that the district court should have been allowed to address. And the failure to object to those things rests on the defendant, especially because the only evidence in the record that he maintains that he remained silent came after the prosecutor asked him the question about what he said to the police. There is not a single shred of record evidence prior to the answer to that question that the defendant maintained he didn't say anything to Chief Jara. How the prosecutor could know that in advance and thus have committed plain prosecutorial misconduct boggles my mind. And I think that's the important lesson here with the plain error analysis and why these sorts of questions need to be presented to district courts. There need to be objections. There should be these kinds of motions should be brought really at the omnibus hearing. Failing that, there should be a motion in limine to preclude the officer from testifying about those sorts of things. And at the very least, there should be an objection at trial. But there wasn't. There was no objection when Chief Jara testified, and there was no objection to this line of inquiry when the defendant testified. And the district court had no opportunity to address that issue and make the credibility determinations, quite frankly, it had to make to resolve the issue that the defendant claims is plain error in this case. And when there are credibility determinations and fact disputes that need to be resolved, again, it's my position that can't possibly be a plain error. Then you can compound that with the fact of competing strains of case law to apply. I don't know how a district court is supposed to, in the moment, in the heat of trial, call to mind three different competing lines of Miranda jurisprudence and try without an objection to sort out whether this testimony is objectionable. I think that's asking for superhuman efforts from both district court judges and prosecutors. I maintain there couldn't be any error here, much less plain error, because it's the state's position that Darvo and Anderson, not Doyle, control this situation. Doyle doesn't apply because where a defendant voluntarily speaks after receiving Miranda warnings, he has not been induced to remain silent. And that's the crux of Anderson and Darvo, is the silence is no longer ambiguous because it hasn't been induced by the Miranda warning. And that's really the due process consideration that underlies Doyle and Wainwright and Billups. The defendant is essentially asking for a right to remain selectively silent, and that's one that the Minnesota Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court have consistently rejected. The right to remain silent is a shield, not a sword. And so it was entirely proper for the prosecutor here to show and comment upon the defendant's failure to relate to police crucial exculpatory statements that he later recited at trial. And for that reason, there was no plain error, and the defendant's conviction should be affirmed. With regard to the question of the departure in this case, the standard of review is clear. These departures are reviewed for an abuse of discretion. But it's important to remember that the Supreme Court pointed out in Soto that that standard of review is not a limitless grant of power to the district court. The record has to truly demonstrate that the defendant is particularly, that is exceptionally, amenable to probation, not simply amenable to probation. And I don't think it's of terrible significance that the district court didn't say the magic words here. That's not the state's position. I think sometimes it's telling about-
So where specifically did he abuse his discretion then, Mr. Smith?
Certainly. The district court abused its discretion when, despite the facts and the record, it concluded that the defendant had a low risk of reoffending. First of all, as-
The test that said that.
There was one, but the combined test said that he had a moderate risk. And first of all, that one test said a low to moderate risk, and the combined test said that he had a moderate risk of recidivism.
So how does he abuse his discretion by reviewing the record and saying, I'm persuaded he has a low to moderate risk?
But my position is that's manifestly contrary to the evidence in the record. The psychosexual... It's not. It says low to moderate risk,
right,
and a combined score of a moderate risk. And I think it's important to move beyond those.
Don't those tests serve different functions?
I believe they do serve different functions. I think it's also important to remember that Soto tells us the mere fact that someone prepares a report, says something, isn't of particular weight. What I think is particularly interesting is if you dive deeper into the psychosexual assessment. The psychosexual assessment reports that the defendant lacks empathy, lacks remorse. Lack of remorse is important because that bears on the defendant's amenability to probation and is relevant to the question of a dispositional departure, something this court recognized in State v. Bowerly in 1994. The defendant had grandiose thought patterns and entitled behavior. Distorted beliefs about the concept of consent, which is a particular issue here, poor boundaries, was hypersexual, and struggles with poor decision-making and impulsivity, particularly amenable to probation.
I'm not trying to trick you when I ask you this question, but I was intrigued when you said the state was not contesting that the district court intended to use the word particularly amenable. You're just arguing that that label was not right for this particular defendant. Is that correct? I'm not trying to have you make a concession, but if you get what I'm getting at.
Sure.
If the words weren't there, we can ferret through the record, but that's a
correct.
Lot of work on our part.
I think it's difficult to tell here whether the district court truly concluded that the defendant was particularly amenable to probation. And I say that
clarifies it for me. I thought you were saying that you accepted that he was intending to find particularly amenable, but that label didn't apply.
No, I'll point out three reasons for that. First, the fact that the district court didn't specifically find that the defendant was particularly amenable to probation. Second, the district court did not complete a departure report and did not make specific written findings in the sentencing order as to the grounds for the departure. So one of those two written things was required by the rules of criminal procedure, and so we're stuck with a record that's a little bit difficult, I think, to review meaningfully because of the district court's failure to comply with the requirements of the rules. But what we do have, I think, demonstrates that the district court simply abused its discretion, even if we just assume for purposes of argument that it intended to find particularly that the defendant was particularly amenable and drill down into the actual findings it made, they don't support the conclusion. And I think Soto is important and instructive on this point, not only for the rule of law that Soto articulates about particular amenability, but for the mode of analysis and assessment, that there has to be a real meaningful review. It's not enough that the district court says that these factors support this. There has to be some actual bearing out of how. And I think the question about age that was raised is particularly relevant here because the defendant's age here and the defendant's age in Soto aren't all that different. And quite frankly, their criminal histories are also not all that different. The defendant here had low-level offenses, but he still had a criminal history. The defendant in Soto had low-level offenses, still had a criminal history. The defendant's most recent offense here was committed shortly, I think, before his sentencing or before his arrest for the current offense.
But in Soto, the crime was much more violent, and the court focused on that. So
I
is that a critical factor in our analysis in this case?
I don't think that's a critical factor. I think that factor only comes in after there's been a proper determination of particular amenability to probation. I think the prospect that because the crime is more heinous, we require more for particular amenability is wrong. And I think the fact that 50% of offenders in this situation get departures demonstrates not thoughtful departures, but disagreement with the sentencing guidelines. And I think this court has to exercise meaningful review to ensure consistency and predictability in sentencing. And for that reason, I would ask this court to reverse the departure in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Rebuttal, Ms. Lynn?
I just wanted to address the one issue that you raised about the whether or not how the evidence came out about the silence coming out during this should be relevant that it came out during the case, the state's case in chief, as far as analyzing whether or not the defendant opened the door versus having to now respond to what was opened by the state. And I think the question gets to the issue here, and the problem here as far as looking at plain error and the impact is that really it does, I think a defendant has to decide at that point, once it's come in during as substantive evidence in the state's case in chief, that will impact the defendant's decision whether or not do I now take the stand because now I have to, this has come out and I have to rebut it versus I'm not going to take the stand, it hasn't come out. I actually do think that's relevant, and I think it would be relevant in assessing whether or not there's plain error. And I think it's also relevant in deciding whether or not it's waived by him taking the stand because it has to be addressed. So I think you're right that is a factor in determining whether or not there's actually error in this case and how it should be addressed. And that's all I wanted to point out. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lynn. And thank you, counsel. The court will take the matter under advisement then at this time, and we will have a decision for you within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you.